Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/ACAST, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/ACAST.
He's known as Basil and Joe. Welcome to the Criminal Connection podcast, Mr. George Russo.
So just growing up, just crime was just like a normal thing.
So how did you start off, George? Was you getting them football stickers out the corner shop?
My mum's mum, she's a McLean. So her brother is Lenny McLean's dad. He met a woman called Shirley Pitts. She was known as the Queen of Thieves. And then they'd say, what about that other thing up there? Maybe because my wife would like that. As soon as you turn your back, bang, you switch the ring. But like drugs are like a massive part of my story. I'm like 15 years clean in recovery. The second summer of love with all the E's and all that, you know. I mean, I'm primarily like a drama person, you know.
Not my wife.
My sort of acting career from being like late teen sort of petered out, and like, I got into the drugs quite, things got quite bad actually. But all the way through that period, I was writing a film for, and the guy that I played, Damon Alvin, there was a really mad connection that I didn't know at the time. And then we wrote Villain, Phil Barantini.
Number one on Netflix.
Well, I come from that world. I'm not a gangster, I know that world. I'm just like a little window opened up. I went, I've got something, bang, and they happened.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome back to the Criminal Connection podcast with myself, Terry Stone, aka the Podfather. Today, we've got a very special guest. He's known as Basil and Joe. Welcome to the Criminal Connection podcast, Mr. George Russo.
Wow. What an introduction. Nice one, Tel.
That's good to see you, mate.
Good to see you too, man.
Yeah. Fucking hell, Basil and Joe.
Yeah.
Who would have thought it?
I know. Yeah.
But George, it's really good to have you on the show. And I wanted to start off by really going back to, you know, when you was younger.
Okay.
I know obviously lots of people, especially actors, draw from real life experiences to put it into their performances and their work. So, you know, it'd be good to know a little bit about how you grew up, your family and where you were born and all that sort of
stuff. Right. Well, I'm from Hoxton originally, which is just down the road from here. But And it's quite an unusual area, Hoxton, because it's like it's all social housing. There's no old Victorian houses there or Georgian houses. It's all, you know, council flats. And sort of growing up during the 80s and even in the 70s, you know, when my mum and dad met, it was almost like an enclave, you know. And London in general was very, very cliquey. So there were no outsiders. And, you know, I always say that I grew up not in the, not from the working class, but from the criminal class, because crime was just a thing that we did. In fact, like, criminals were lauded. They were really respected, you know, where I come from. So just growing up, just crime was just like a normal thing.
So how did you start off, George? Was you getting in football stickers at the corner shop?
No, do you know what? I was never really into football. And I never really, like, I was never really into crime myself directly. But like my my mum's mum, she's a McLean. So her brother is Lenny McLean's dad. So my mum and Lenny McLean are first cousins. And then my mum's real dad. So my mum and my nan and my granddad, my mum's mum and dad, this is quite complicated, had just my mum, and then they both went off and started families, right? And so my mum's side are McLean's, and my mum's dad's side, he met a woman called Shirley Pitts, who's from the area, and she was known as the Queen of Thieves. She's got a book about her called Gone Shopping. So she was what they call a hoister, or in Oxton we call them oysters, you know?
Is that what they used to say? I'm going shopping.
Well, that's where the book comes from. So they'd say, "Where's Mummy gone?" And they'd say, "Oh, she's gone shopping." And really, she was like up the West End. So they weren't like the oysters you get today that were junky oysters. These were proper, like, they were going to the West End in disguises, in teams, and nick like high end, you know, quality designer brands.
What disguises did she wear then?
Well, she because like the store detectives would recognise her. She'd have to go in and wear, like, you know, different outfits. And she did all sorts of, like, her book's quite amazing, actually.
I want to,
like,
read that, George.
You should read it, you know. And, like, she did, like, audacious things, like pretending to be a mannequin as, like, the store detectives were running past. So, like, you know, I grew up with all these fantastical stories, like armed robbers around, and my uncle Carrots was a con man, you know, and, like, a proper, you know, at the corner, they called it. He used to call it robberies with violins. You know, because you weren't directly robbing them, but you would, like, it was always out of greed. You would entice them through greed.
So what was greed
that would get you out, you know.
So what would be one of his, have you got an example of one of his?
Well, it'd be the type of thing, like, it'd be from, like, having, like, a load of videos. He'd show you a few. He'd say they're really cheap, you know what I mean? And, like, show you, he'd open a few boxes and it'd be the deal of a century. And he'd say, we need the money now. We've got to have it lively. And so they think they're getting, like, the deal of a century. Little do they know they've bought, a lorry load of bricks.
Right.
And like, it disappear in a toilet. What he liked was what they call a thruer. So a thruer is when you'd have, like, an exit that no one knew about. So you'd have a toilet with an exit somewhere, like in a pub. So you'd meet someone in a boozer, you know, say, "I'm just going to go to the toilet to look at some gear or something." And then it'd be out the back door or he'd have rings. One of the best ones, he'd have like a real diamond ring, like a 30 grand ring. And then he'd have like a load of rings that were the fake diamonds. They begin with a Z.
Fugazes.
Your fugazes, that's it. I forget what they're called. Zircons.
Zircons, yeah.
And then he would show you the ring, and then he'd say, what about that other thing up there? Maybe because my wife would like that. As soon as you turn your back, bang, he'd switch the ring.
So he'd duck and out in garden, he'd be...
Yeah, like all over. Like, and whenever he used to go and watch, because him and Lenny were quite close, whenever he'd go and watch Lenny fight, he'd be like sort of hiding in the shadows because he'd fuck so many people. he could come on him from anywhere.
He'd speak to your granny about the fucking giving one of these guys.
Yeah, exactly. So this is what I grew up with. You know, my mum was a hoister, so she worked with Shirley and she taught.
Shirley still around?
No, Shirley's dead. Oh, yeah, she's long dead.
And so we'll get on a show.
I know, yeah. Well, her kids are around, you know, so maybe they'd like to come on. But yeah, I've been developing a TV series for years, like been working on it about Hoxton and that era, because it was such a, you know, the late sort of 70s were just such a fascinating era before the heroin came in, you know, because heroin then come in later on and just sort of just decimated Hoxton. It really did.
I was sort of like the other side. I was in Camberley in Surrey.
Okay.
And I was living on a council estate and... Yeah, when I grew up on it, it was probably like Oxton, loads of crime, loads of violence, loads of people behaving badly. But then when that sort of rave scene, everyone was on that sort of rave buzz. And then the same thing, this heroin thing. I mean, I never understood why anybody would take it.
Yeah.
If someone said to you, inject yourself with this shit and you're going to fucking basically just lay in a coma all fucking day and then you're going to rob your own mum to get some more. I don't see what the attraction
is. It doesn't make sense. But the problem was that no one had that point of reference because heroin was new,
right.
You see. So it was a new drug. So people took it, numbed off, felt good. I mean, it had been described as like kissing God, heroin. You know, the feeling that it, I mean, they don't take it because it don't fucking feel good. Do you know what I mean?
You're selling it to me, Jason.
No, I've never tried it. Like, I'll just say, but like, because I had that point of reference. I saw what it done. I saw it done to my own family, you know.
People dying of it and all sorts.
Sure. And all the chaps that would have been the people that we looked up to that would have sort of, for want of a better expression, groomed you into a life of crime.
Right.
They were all gone, you know, when I was growing up. They were all junkies. Because before that it was pills and sulfate, you know, cocaine hadn't quite hit.
Right.
And so when heroin came, it was just a new drug that was going about and, you know, it wiped out a whole generation. It really, really did. So. But, you know, my dad was a... he was training to be a chartered accountant. He was a reader, you know, really intelligent fella. And
that's where you get it from.
Maybe. And so he met my mum, and my mum was, you know, in Oxton, wrapped around all these thieves, and he'd be going out while it was dark and coming home while it was dark. And my mum would go out like twice a week, come home with more money than he earned in a month. And he thought, fucking hell, what am I doing? This is a mugs game. So he started thieving, and he would do like the jump up and warehouses, like Furriers were big in Hackney. So they would burgle like Furriers, which is like they get the furs, all the pelts,
right.
And a lot of there's a lot of big factories in Hackney back then, the Burberry factory and things like that, and I'm sure there were lots of others, but I know that they had a few quid.
That's why when you walk around London, everyone had fucking Burberry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but that's how we got nice stuff growing up. We couldn't afford it, so it was always from oysters, from the jump up. You know, that's how we got our bits and pieces.
I mean,
that's how we survived.
It's actually quite funny because most fashion brands, right. Do a lot of PR marketing campaign, but obviously Burberry didn't need to do it because everyone was nicking it and just giving it out, and everyone's wearing it, and everyone's going, "Oh, that's nice. I might buy one of them."
So. Exactly. Yeah. So you know, that's the environment that I grew up in. It was just normal. You know, crime was just a normal thing. It wasn't anything to be ashamed of. In fact, I was kind of ashamed of it growing up because you couldn't tell anyone. Because the first things we were taught as a kid was don't tell on your friends. You know, don't never be a grass. A grass was like the worst thing you could be because people would be taken from their families and locked away for years and years. And, you know, like grasses and nonces were the two things.
Sounds like
a saying about moustaches, isn't it?
Sounds, you know, like Goodfellas.
Yeah. You know the saying about moustaches? Only nonces and grasses wear moustaches. That's why I always have a beard and never a tash.
Right. I've never heard that.
You never heard that? Yeah, well, that's the environment I was brought up in, you know, that you just, you know, and we didn't like, there was no outsiders. It was very, very, very cliquey. And, but then later on, you know, my dad, he always sort of dabbled in like pills and drugs. And then he started sort of selling heroin when it first came into the area.
Right.
And then he got addicted to heroin. And then it just ripped my family apart, you know. And at one point now my uncles were on it, my aunties were on it, and it was just.
How old was you then, George?
So, I mean, I was young. I must have been about four or five. You know, my earliest memories are like there was always drugs in the house, puff or something. You know, and dramas.
Did you have any awareness what was going on, or did you just, was that normal? Because you sort of come downstairs and there was the drug paraphernalia around, people smoking.
Yeah, I mean,
joints.
It's really sad thinking back. Like, you know, I wasn't allowed in the room at one point. I remember my dad used to make these like plasticine superheroes for me, and he'd say, "I'll make you a plasticine superhero, wait outside the door," and they'd be waiting out there for ages while they were just sitting in there taking drugs, you know what I mean? And like, I think at that time it was probably like puffing and drinking, and then slowly like the heroin came along, and by the grace of God, my mum never liked it or never took it, and she just was like, she didn't want her kids growing up in that environment, so she rightly so got us out of there. But before that, there was a lot of turmoil, a lot of drama. Like my mum and dad used to fight terribly, and the problem was is that where we lived in Hoxton, in the flats, over the road was my nan and all my uncles, and they were heavy, you know what I mean? So my dad used to try and get heavy with my mum, and then she'd just ring her uncles and they'd come over and just belt the life out of him. I remember being a kid and just my sister cuddling me and, like, you know, really heavy trauma, and like my dad screaming as he's getting a belt in from my heavy uncle.
Can you imagine? You wouldn't want fucking Lenny McLean knocking on your door, would you?
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, Lenny, yeah, he belt you just for, you know.
I mean, he was a ferocious fighter.
Yeah.
And obviously he come out of, you know, that sort of security criminal world and become an actor, didn't he?
He did.
Lockstock was his movie debut, wasn't it?
I mean, he was like the legend in our family, you know what I mean? Right. Like when Lenny was about, it was like a movie star was about, you know, and my nan loved him and my uncle Martin, especially, like, just idolised him. And yeah, you know, so, and he was just a larger than life character. The thing that they don't get right about Lenny is his humour. Right. And in the Hoxton wit, he could have been a stand-up comic, honestly. He was so funny, mate. So funny.
I only met him once. Right. But when I met him, I looked at him and I went, this geezer's like a fucking unit, because his head was like that. His hands were like that.
Yeah.
And he was just so big, you know. He was like a cartoon character.
Yeah, and he had presence, but he knew how to use it. He knew in a room, like he was like a sight to behold, you know what I mean? So he had presence. He knew he was a force to be reckoned with.
When he spoke, he really liked that, wasn't he?
And he would hold the attention of the room, and he loved the attention, you know what I mean? And he would just hold the centre of the room. And that's what I mean. He could have been a comic, you know? I remember him telling me a story about, I think he was like at the Hippodrome or one of these places, and a tramp was trying to steal his tyres. And so he said he got him by the scruff of the neck. He said, I couldn't belt him. You know what I mean? So he took him into the cloakroom. He gave him a pen and paper and made him write 1,000 lines. I must not steal Lenny's tyres. You know what I mean? That's the humour. Whoever he did that on, I don't know, he probably did, but, you know.
That's funny.
He was just a funny, funny man, you know, and they don't really capture that. And,
did you watch that film, My Name is Lenny?
I'm in it.
Right.
I'm in it. I played Frank Warren in it.
Oh, really? Yeah. Do you know, no, the only reason I was asking was because that was a film that I didn't get to see.
Ah.
But I was going to ask you what you thought about it.
Yeah, no, it's a good effort, you know. It was a really good film. I think that, you know, the lead guy in it, he really, like, looked like Lenny. And, you know, my cousin Jamie produced it, and he did a fantastic job producing it. And I think it done really well, you know. Yeah. And, it kind of captured that time, that period of time.
Because obviously our mutual friend Craig Fairbrass was in the frame to play Lenny McLean years ago, wasn't he?
Yeah, when, he was, and he would have been perfect.
There was a guy, this was like years ago, wasn't it, trying to put together a movie about him.
So what I kind of know about that, is I don't know the ins and outs, but I think a guy like bought the rights and had the rights to it, and that's why they got in just like basically like, you know, contract hell through trying to get it produced. And I think that the guy owned the rights and they had to wait for the rights to run out, and he basically wasn't getting it made. And so they just missed their window with Craig. But Craig, I mean, Lenny wanted him to.
They saw it on the doors together, didn't they? So
I think he would have been perfect. You know, I couldn't have thought of a better person really to play him. Yeah.
So obviously you've gone through this, you know, traumatic childhood, and then what happened with your dad?
My mum left my dad, you know, and it's, you know, and I don't know whether it's sort of like growing up on the outskirts of society, but my mum, you know, when you're from that criminal class, you're very suspicious of the mainstream narrative, you know, and so that my mum's always sort of thought outside the box. And one of the ways she sort of done that was firstly through like nutrition, like food that she ate. My mum was eating like macrobiotic organic food for as long as I can remember. You know, the first Whole Food shops in London she would go to and be eating organic food. And my other family like used to laugh at us, you know, because we weren't allowed like certain things. We'd have to put our own salt and vinegar on our crisps. We weren't allowed sugar. And I'd go to my nan's and I'd want like, you know, Marx's chocolate biscuits, and my uncles would come in and go, get back over there, you're not allowed that. Right. You know what I mean? You're allowed, have some nuts. You know, take the piss out of me. But like, but little did they know that, like, you know, now like organic food and this commonplace, you know, everyone's eating organic food and sort of, you know, my mum was vegan before it was cool to be vegan, no dairy, no, you know, really like hardcore into nutrition. So, and also she really supported anything that I did create. So anything I took an interest in, she got behind me.
That's what you need as a kid, don't you?
She encouraged me, like, creatively. And she showed me a lot of love, you know, like, I was brought up with a lot of love. And she really, anything creative, like, if I wanted to paint or draw, she'd buy me all the paints, or might chore a few, right, you know. She'd, like, get me all the gear, you know, and I remember sort of being a young kid, and, my era was the era of the video shop.
Right.
Good, you know, days, I grew up in fucking video shops. That was my era, like, going in a video shop on a Saturday and perusing all the covers, you know, the odd pirate from behind the counter, right, and taking them two or three films. So that was our internet back then, you know. Right. The Atari games didn't quite do it, so we watched films. And right. And my childhood logic was like, if I'm an actor, I can be a soldier, you know, a doctor, a fireman. I was going to say policeman, but, you know, never.
Frank Warren,
you know, Basil and Joe. So that, you know, that was my childhood, you know, logic of, like, sort of saying I can be anything if I can, right. I, you know, and I loved films. So my mum put my name down when I was about 5, 6 at the Anna Shear Theatre.
Wicked.
And it was a 4-year waiting list. And then I went there, and that's how sort of, like, the acting thing came about.
Yeah, because it was funny, because when I was at school, I remember the drama people, it was just like the weirdos that did it, you know what I mean? So I never did the drama at school, because I was always like, oh, no, the weirdos do that.
Pretending to be a leaf.
Yeah, and all that. Tree, I'm a tree. But, I mean, that in a share is a great, I mean, I've never been, but everyone I know said it was a breeding ground for great actors and actresses.
It's a fantastic place. And, you know, 4-year waiting list, it didn't matter, you know, if you had money or not. So you know, the kids out of the flats there, and there was, you know, politicians' children there, you know, so it was a melting pot of all different people. And it was just great. And everyone was equal, and you all got a chance to perform.
Did you stay in Hoxton then?
No, we sort of moved around. We went to, like, Victoria Park for a little while, you know, and then back, and then we moved back to like Old Street.
And with your dad, did he, like, get off the drugs and then change his ways?
Do you know what? It was always off and on, and then sort of like he's very ill now at the moment, and the last 11, 12 years we've got very close, and he sort of slowed everything down.
Do you know what? It's really good to hear that, George, because, you know, like, when I sort of grew up, my dad was bang on the drink. Not gotcha. Drugs, just bang on the drink.
Yeah.
And it's a similar sort of thing where my mum and dad went like that because of the way my dad behaved, and then you sort of don't have that father figure in your life.
Yeah.
But, you know, the one thing it did, it put me off fucking drinking like that, and I'm sure that's probably put you off.
Well, drugs, do you know, I'd like to say it did. It put me off taking heroin, but, like, drugs are, like, a massive part of my story. I'm like, 15 years clean in recovery.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Right.
So okay. I haven't had a drink for 15 years. I'm in my 15th year of recovery.
You're so bubbly and happy, George. When I see you at the premiere, I thought, he's got to run a couple of drinks, mate.
No.
You're just on the OJ.
No, it took a long time for me to get like that, you know, because when I first stopped drinking, I was really self-conscious in social situations, because I'd always, and it wasn't really the drink, if I'm honest, that was the problem. It always led to the other gear, and that was my real problem, you know. And so, even though I had all them examples of not to go down that road, I had, like, you know, like, my sister never touched a drink or a drug, you know, and she has a little drink, like a normal person, but she's never been into it. But for some reason, I just gravitated towards drinking. I almost had, like, this fixation. I was obsessed with them, drugs. Like, I thought people that took drugs were cool for some reason.
That is a narrative, though, isn't it? If you look at a lot of kids now, and I've noticed this, like, I mean, we're in 2023 now, but obviously, when you go out now, I mean, you go to a restaurant and people come out the toilet sniffing. Everywhere.
Yeah.
And you just and to me, it's sort of like, because I've obviously put on events and I've been around people, you know when people are fucking off their nuts.
Of course.
So, and it does shock me at how many people you meet in the randomest places. Like, you go in a hotel and you're walking in a hotel and someone walks past you going, and you're just like, what is fucking wrong with these people? Do you know what I mean?
I mean, it's kind of like socially accepted. So that was the confusing thing for me. So when I was sort of like, I went to like Anna Shears, and I was like a child actor, and I was at Anna Shears with some great people, you know, like some really.
Please tell me you was in Grangeville.
I wasn't actually. It's the one show I wasn't in. A lot of friends that were in Grangeville.
Roland.
Yeah. Funny enough, like, I lived a couple of doors along from Zammo, Lee, forget his second name now.
I know you mean. Yeah. I was brought up on Grangeville.
So. Yeah, yeah. So Lee and his family lived a couple of doors along from me. But now Grangeville was one of the things that I wasn't in. But like at a very young age, like I sort of did EastEnders. I had a little stint in there.
How old was you when you got your first break then, George? What was it?
I don't know. I first started acting. I wouldn't call it a break, but... My first ever job was a radio play called Shambolic Rainbow with Neil Maskell.
Right, amazing.
Me and him, and I think it was his first job as well.
He's great, Neil.
He's great. He's been my friend all through my life, really.
I always remember the first time I met him on the first Rise of the Foot Soldier film. Mm. And do you remember that scene where Pat's in the hospital bed?
Yeah.
There's a girl with her tits out.
Yeah.
And everyone's sniffing coke off of her tits. And like, we're shaking the bed and everyone's going, ah. And literally he had to walk in. And when he walked in, he just looked around as if to say, like, what the fuck am I walking into here?
Yeah,
I'm a serious actor, you know. But Neil's great. I mean, I've worked with him on a few things.
Yeah.
But I'm seeing his career go from strength to strength.
Mate, he's always phenomenal. Knew that he was going to do something special. Like, he's just directed and written his first feature. And that's what I always had him pegged as. He was always a great actor.
Right.
But he's real... talent was always like when he used to write plays, and he's so well read. He's such an intellectual.
He reads The Guardian
so much.
He reads The Guardian.
I mean, he's always been really, really clever. Like, my mum used to say, like, he was 14 going on 40, you know, years ago.
Dexter Fletcher, great actor, but as a director, he's just like taking over Hollywood.
Taking off. So Neil's managing to sort of tread both worlds. You know, he's a fantastic actor, one of my favourite actors, and. You know, and he's going to be a brilliant writer director, no doubt.
Do you know what the film's called?
Clockadluder.
Right. Okay.
It's a Belgian word. I'm not quite sure what it means actually, but I know that his wife is from Belgium. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, yeah. I have to look out for that.
Mm-hmm. It's got really good reviews, and it's done well.
So that was your first, you know, break or first job, whatever you call it, and then. So where'd you go from there? Did you get an agent?
So yeah, there was an agency with the Anna Shear Theatre. So I worked pretty much like consistently, you know, up until sort of like my early to late teens. And at the same time, you know, I started puffing, found girls, you know, I was taking E's and trips and all that, like at quite a young age, too young really. And by the age of like 15, I was like knocking about with some older people.
Huh? 15?
About 15, 16.
Okay, you started young.
Oh, I did, mate. I was like puffing at 12, you know, 11, 12, puffing, draw, and like, you know. So like by 15, 16, like I was knocking about with some older people, and like a close friend of mine, still a really close friend, like he come from a very religious family, and like we'd done all these drugs together. I don't know if they'd fuck my head up, but I think I was always looking for something till. Always looking for something more. You know, I believe that when we're born as kids, we're like connected to
absolutely
to a power. You know, I don't want to call it God because there's so much baggage with that word, but they're connected to the universe, to whatever it is, nature. You know, when I used to watch my little girl playing with like an apple or something, she'd be like, you know, just the wonder in her eyes, just playing with it, just connected and tuned in. And somewhere along the line, I lost that connection, you know, and I think I looked for it in other things. And drugs, I think, was one of the things where I sort of found some sort of, I don't know, it hit the spot for me somehow.
I had a similar experience, and I actually put your experience down to my experience that we had absent fathers.
Right.
And I think when you have an absent father, you haven't got a role model, you haven't got that male guiding thing, and you're always, like you said, looking for something. And how I dealt with it is I'd never been christened or confirmed.
Right.
But there was a church on my estate, and I went there and did it all.
Right.
Because I thought that was the right thing to do.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
As I've got older,
yeah,
I've looked back on my life and I've gone, you know, God is whatever you want it to be.
Exactly. Right? It's a very personal thing, isn't it? It
can be a woman.
Mm.
Religion is really, like, you might be a Muslim, I might be a Christian, you might be a Roman Catholic. It doesn't matter. It
doesn't.
Right? We're all one.
Yeah.
We're all the same.
Mm.
We just have different interpretations of what God is to us.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I genuinely believe that all the religions do actually divide people, because there's been wars since the beginning of time where people have persecuted other people because they don't agree with their religion or their God or their views. And I genuinely think that the universe, and I think when you're searching for what the meaning is, or you're searching for something that feels like it's missing.
Yeah.
you know, I actually believe acting is a spiritual thing.
100%.
When you're doing 100%. That stuff, and yeah. you're channeling those characters, yeah. you're working, there is that sort of, it feels spiritual.
It is, mate, because like for me, acting, acting is for me is being in the moment and being present. Obviously, there's a lot of work I do beforehand, we do beforehand, and, you know, to try and get to that spot. And some people have it more intuitively than others. Others are just able just to do it. But, you know, so we do all our prep, but ultimately it's about being in the moment. And all the real good stuff is the spontaneous stuff. All the real magic happens when you're in the present, you know. And that's what I believe it is, being in the now, and it's channeling, you know, that presence. Like for me, it's about, I try and really just listen to my breathing before I take or before you go on stage. And sometimes I rub my hands just to feel, you know, that I'm here and now, and then try and be in the moment as much as possible, you know. So it is definitely spiritual. It's like a meditation almost. And when you're in that flow state, you're right, it does feel spiritual.
So going back to the drug stuff, right?
Yeah.
So obviously you're going out, you're partying, you're drinking, you're smoking, you're pilling, you're doing whatever, you've got all these girls, you're having a great time. When would you say was when you actually went and you saw the light and you went, I need to stop doing this?
Well, it was a long time actually. So what happened was so I was puffing, then I got into religion with my friend for a little while and I stopped everything. And I was like, I've always been very obsessive. So I was like obsessed with it. I was like almost fanatical, like, you know, and then at about 18, I was seeing all my other mates, you know, partying, birds, they're out raving and all that. And I consciously made a decision to walk away from religion. And that had a real detrimental effect on me because I believed that because I wasn't following a certain religion,
right,
I couldn't have a relationship with a higher power.
Right.
And so that's when my drug taking took off, and that's when the cocaine came in. Right. And I got into cocaine. And at that time, you know, people were all pressing it and, like, you know, selling keys, and just gear just seemed to be just gear everywhere. You know, you're talking about like the late 90s, early 2000s. It stopped being a really expensive drug, which I believe it is again now. I believe it's quite expensive now, some of the good stuff. But it's sort of become like, you could just, anyone could afford it.
I know, like when I talk to people that are older, you know, in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, if you did that, it was like a posh person's drug.
Exactly.
You know, because it was expensive.
Yeah, yeah.
Couldn't get hold of it freely.
That's right.
And then it does seem like the late 90s, I mean, we've noticed this in the club scene, it went from everyone being happy,
yeah,
everyone have a good time, to people sniffing and smoking crack, and then literally, the mood changed.
Yeah.
The guns come out, the knives come out. It went really dark.
So exactly. So I caught the tail end of that rave scene, and then right, the jungle scene, which I was banging into the jungle scene.
Well, you must have come to a rave, One Nation.
Probably did come to a One Nation. and I loved the jungle scene, you know what I mean? But there was always that element of like crack, and like it was dark, but it was kind of it was the style of the music, you know what I mean? And then, but once the garage scene kicked in and the Charlie kicked in, it was like suits, whistles, Gucci loafers, back to the wall,
champagne,
everyone, all different firms nutting at each other from across right, the room. No one was really dancing and getting down, you know what I mean, like they used to in the jungle days. So the vibe changed, you know.
Well, I always remember there was a mad story at the Coliseum in Vauxhall,
right,
where some girl had had a row with somebody and somebody pulled a gun out and they'd gone outside and they shot whoever this was and then put them in a fucking wheelie bin and then went back into the rave. And like a few days later, when they come to empty the wheelie bin, there was a fucking dead person that had been shot in the fucking wheelie bin outside the back of the club. Shit. I mean, that shit was like crazy.
Yeah,
And, you know, I think I sold my business and come out of that scene in 2003.
Right.
And that was really when it got so bad.
Yeah.
You'd ring up the club and say, I want to book the club. And they'd be like, what music is it? And you'd be like, no thanks for the phone.
What was it, the garage, all the garage music?
Garage. Yeah. I mean, we did Brixton Academy for our last ever One Nation. We had 5,000 people in there. But with the garage, because you had So Solid Crew, Heartless Crew, you had Pay As You Go Cartel, you had all these crews.
Yeah.
And then you had all the drive-by shootings. It all got
you had
so
the
bad.
That come with
got
it.
So bad that the law enforcement, the clubs, everyone was like, the councils, they were all like, you know, who's playing at this event? And you'd be like, well, we want to book. No. I mean, they pulled the So Solid Crew's tour. Because it wasn't necessarily them that was causing the problem, but the people that was following them, you know, you get people from South London, that don't mix with the people in North London and East London and West London. Yeah. And then you'd have some from Manchester, some from Birmingham. And they'd all be in the same place. And it's just literally going to go off.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons.
Which
why.
Sort of went away, like that tribalism that came, you know, that went, you know, the football tribalism that sort of went away with the, you know, the second summer of love with all the E's and all that, you know. That sort of came back, didn't it, in a weird way.
It was weird because I can't remember who said this, right? But someone said to me, if the government had invented ecstasy, which they didn't, but if they had done, it was the most genius invention of all time because it made everyone in the recession happy.
and
all the football hooligans that would want to stab and kill each other, all cuddling each other, saying, I fucking love you.
Yeah. I remember someone saying, if they really want to solve the problem in the Middle East or these problems, just drop a load of, like, the old doves, you know, the old, proper old love doves, and it'd soon be wagging and kissing. And, you know.
The thing is, though, do you know what? As I've got older and I've looked more at the world, I do actually think that everybody just gets everybody at it. So I genuinely think the world is a peaceful place.
Yeah.
And I think actually everybody just wants to get on
and
earn a living. But I just think that there's certain people.
It's egos as well.
We don't like what you're doing here.
Yeah.
Stop doing it. And then you go, fuck you. And then I'm having a problem with you. And then they're getting involved. So, but then obviously there's money being made, right? So I don't think, someone said to me the other day, if there's a war, there's normally a reason for that. And it's not always because of religion or politics.
Or some moral reason.
It's because they want some money or they don't like the person that's running that and they need somebody else to come in.
Sure. I mean, we don't know what goes on behind
We're just actors and fucking film producers.
You know, I'm sure there's a lot more. And since the advent of the internet, like, I mean, years ago, you would be able to, like, you know, in my nan and granddad's days, you'd be able to whip the whole country up into a frenzy to be queuing up to go to war. Now, since the internet, we're all a little bit more, you know, dubious. We realise there's a lot more to it, and we don't necessarily believe the narrative, you know, the party line. We tend to question it a lot more. And definitely, like, us working class people and us criminal class people, we've always, you know, like, people like my mum has always been suspicious of you know, the government or the mainstream,
right.
You know. It's just the way we are, suspicious by nature, you know.
Well, someone said to me, you know, in life, and this is a good lesson for, you know, younger people watching and listening to this podcast and older people, you know, whatever anybody tells you, always question it.
Always.
Just because someone says to you, if you go outside, you know, the sun's shining, right? You go outside and it's raining, you go, well, I thought the sun was shining. But, you know, you've got to check.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And someone said to me the other day, they was talking about something, and I said, I said, I've never heard so much shit in all my life, right? I said, where'd you get this shit from? And they said, oh, well, I typed it into Google and I fact-checked it and it said it's true. And I said, mate, I said, who do you think's fucking fact-checking it?
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Mm. I said, so, you know, if somebody tells you something or if something is on the internet, just because it's on the internet doesn't mean it's true.
Right? And so you can't even believe what you see now with all the AI and all this stuff. So, you know.
I mean, you know, they could actually deepfake you, George, walking down the road, saying whatever they want you to say, and then go, oh, look, we just saw George outside a film premiere talking about whatever. And then all of a sudden...
Yeah, it's scary.
It's scary, mate.
It's scary times, you know?
But I think it'd be interesting to see where it goes.
Yeah.
Obviously, we've talked about, obviously, what's made you George Russo. And, you know, you've obviously done these acting jobs. And would you say... out of your career, that you know, if someone sends you a script, what sort of roles do you gravitate to? Do you sort of like playing a bad guy, or do you like playing, you know?
I mean, I'm primarily like a drama person. You know, I like drama. So, like, my favorite era of filmmaking.
Not my wife.
mine too. But So like my favorite era of filmmaking is like the American films of the 70s, you know, so all the great movies.
They were
the best. So like Taxi Driver, you know, One Flew Over a Cuckoo's Nest, you know, Apocalypse Now, all the great movies of that era are my favourite films sort of like today, and I tend to rewatch a lot of those. So anything that has like a lot of layer to it. Obviously, I write a lot of stuff, you know, and the work that I've written myself and been in That's the stuff that I've enjoyed doing the most, because obviously it's dealing with subject matters and things that I want to write about and want to talk about, you know. So
there's not, I mean, when you talk about movies, right? And I always think, and Pete have asked me this, and I'm sure Pete have asked you it as well.
Mm.
And I think the stupidest question anybody could ask anybody is, "What's your favorite gangster film?"
Yeah.
Because there isn't one.
There isn't one.
There's no, probably no. 10.
Yeah.
What would you, I mean, you know, if I put you on the spot now, I don't want you to put me in any order.
Yeah.
But what would you say were the films that you watched that were sort of, because obviously it's a crime podcast.
I mean, there's so many good gangster films, and obviously the Americans do it so well, you know, like and that's why I think it's a genre that can be done well, you know, and I think it has been done badly here in the UK. And obviously, like we did, like there was Lock, Stock, and that sort of set off this trend of where, you know, you had this Cockney geezers, and then a lot of people that had no sort of business writing films started to write them, and you know, and they've become almost like a parody of themselves, right. You know. But I still think there's an opportunity to do some really quality genre, you know, gangster films that have drama, almost like in the vein of the 70s. And that's what we tried to do with sort of Villain. But, you know, my favourite film, hands down, of all time, I can say what my favourite film is.
Oh, really? You have one?
Yeah, it's Taxi Driver.
Wow.
And that's a little homage to Taxi Driver there. But, like, it's...
Go on, George, do it.
I think it's the... What's that? I won't embarrass myself.
Oh, come on. Give us your best in the hero, mate.
I'll do it afterwards. But, you know, yeah, I think it's a... Although, like, I think, you know, probably Casino and like, Wolf of Wall Street you know, Goodfellas are better made films. I just think it's where Scorsese found his voice. It's where performance and writing Paul Schrader's script, like, it just all comes together. For me, it's just a masterpiece, and I watch it at least, like, once a year. But, you know, Goodfellas is up there, you know, obviously, in Casino and Scarface. For me, Casino and Scarface are like the Wanderers and the Warriors.
Yeah.
They're like ones like an opera, larger than life, like cocaine, and, you know, and then Goodfellas is more sort of like low-key, you know, like the movie The Wanderers. You know that movie, The Wanderers?
Yeah, of course.
Classic film.
I genuinely, like, I remember when I think I was 16, and someone said to me, have you seen... We was talking about gangster films, and they said, have you seen Scarface? And
yeah.
I said, no. And they give me the DVD or the VHS or whatever it was of this film, and I watched it, and I was like, oh, my fucking God. And I remember saying to somebody, that was fucking unbelievable.
It's unbelievable.
And I must have watched it fucking 20 times.
Mate, and me and my friends, we just still today, we go back and forth, just quoting it. We don't say anything else. We're just quoting Scarface constantly.
Like, why don't you put your head up
your
ass?
Yeah, there's so many in there. There's just hundreds of them, you know? And all the characters, and it's one of them, you know, the truly great films are the ones that you can watch and you notice something different every time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, I think I was watching, Quadrophenia was on the other day, and then I realised that in the same year, you know, Quadrophenia was made, Scum was made, Wanderers, The Warriors, it was like the greatest year for, like, youth movies, you know, yeah. And... yeah, so this has been some great British. I mean, The Long Good Friday, obviously, is obviously a classic.
Thing is, though, even though
and performance was, as well, performance with Mick Jagger.
Even though The Long Good Friday was a great film, and we have had some great British films here,
right? Yeah,
gangster films. But I do think, like you said earlier, the Americans, you know, Scarface, Scorsese. I mean, there's just so many. I mean, yeah, and the bar is so high. I mean, yeah. You know,
But that's why I think we can do them over here, because the bar isn't so high, and there's an opportunity for us to make, like, really good crime movies that have, like, layer, and, like, if you know script writing, and you can put, like, subtext and story and heart, and, you know, and melodrama, because really that's what people want to watch. People want to watch the human story. You know, like Goodfellas is a love story. You know, do you know what I mean? He's in love with a mob, and he's in love with his wife. You know, yeah, and that's what people really want to watch. They connect to the human element. All the stuff in Scarface with Manny and his sister—that's the real meat and gravy of, you know, his love for Elvira. You know, that's the real meat and gravy of the film. The fact that it's not set in a laundrette and it's set in, you know, in cocaine-ridden, you know, Miami in the '80s, makes it high stakes, and you want to watch it. But if, you know, there's no reason why we can't make quality British crime movies.
I mean, Carlito's Way.
Oh, I love it. I watched it the other day. It's a great movie.
I didn't think much of Carlito's Way too.
I didn't see that. I got to remember.
No, you haven't missed it. But the first one was unbelievable.
Yeah, well, it's Brian De Palma, the same person that did Scarface. It's the same team and a few
characters. I mean, you know, Pacino, you know, I think, you know, when you look at his career, I think, you know, Scarface, Carlito's Way and The Godfather was, you know, one and two. I never really liked the third one.
No.
But I just loved the fact, you know, hearing the story about how that was made.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, you had, you know, Francis Ford Coppola, he wanted Brando, he wanted Pacino, and he was the studio was like, no fucking way, not in the movie, blah, blah, blah. And he fought two for now. And when you watch the movies now, you kind of think this guy was a genius, because you would never in a million years imagine anybody else.
Yeah, it's like Sonny. I think that Jack Nicholson, who was one of my favorite actors, I love Nicholson. He was offered the part of Sonny, who James Caan played, and he turned it down. But like, you can't imagine anyone else playing in Sonny.
That must have been
Thief.
One of...
I love is one of my favorite films.
Which one?
Thief with James Caan.
I'll have to check that.
Right. It's an unreal film. It's Michael Mann who did Heat, so it's almost like a prequel to Heat. Almost unreal film. I love Heat as well. It's a great movie. The Town, another good movie.
I didn't like when I watched Heat though. I didn't like Pacino playing a cop.
Yeah,
I wanted him to play a bad guy.
Oh no,
I wanted him. I know what you mean. I watched it thinking it's a great movie. Yeah. I just want him to kill somebody or chain somebody up.
Yeah. But you know, you either have De Niro as the cop or Pacino. You can't have them both, really. Yeah,
but you needed them both as the bad guys, and have someone else's.
Yeah, maybe. You know. Yeah.
But it was a good movie.
Great film.
But when would you say? I mean, obviously that was when you had your first break.
Yeah.
And then when did you play your first sort of? You know, what was the first gangster film or the first crime role that you?
My sort of acting career from being like late teens sort of petered out, and like I got into the drugs quite, things got quite bad actually. But all the way through that period, I was writing a film.
Right.
Like I met a guy that I'd auditioned for, and we tried to get this feature off the ground, and he became a mentor and a collaborator, a friend of mine called Lee Sales.
Right.
And so that film didn't happen, but we started writing a film together. And during sort of like my ups and downs and the dramas that were going on, I still managed to write this film. Right. And then it's so amazing. Like as soon as I got into recovery and dealt with my addiction. Opportunities just started opening up. Neil Maskell actually asked me to be the lead in his short. It's an obscure little film called Shit Kicker. Right. You can't find it really anymore, right. But it's a great little short. And through that, I met the people that went on to produce my first feature that I'd written called Turnout.
Right.
And Neil Maskell helped me get that off the ground and that was like the first sort of proper thing that I did.
I remember that. You, yeah. Fernando was in that one.
Peter Ferdinando, yeah. Neil Maskell, Ophelia Lovey Bond, great cast. And the James Friend who shot it won the Academy Award this year. I think it was this year. Yeah, he won the Academy Award for All Quiet on the Western Front. So we got an Academy Award winning DOP on it. It's a great movie, but it got picked up by Revolver.
Yeah.
And when they went under, the film sort of went under and it went somewhere else.
We had a few problems with them as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the biggest challenges of film, you know, distributors going out of business, sales agencies going out of business. And I mean, Revolver in their day were probably the best.
That's why we went with them, because they were the biggest, but Vertigo wanted it at the same time. But you know, I don't think they offered as much money. And I wanted to go with Vertigo, but
Vertigo, out of all the still companies, have been the most staunch and the most reliable.
They're proper.
You know, that's good. It's good. Yeah. They've done very well.
And so that film's with 101 now, a company called 101, and I've been speaking to them all year because the film, like they didn't know they had the film. The drives were somewhere else and they just had artwork, but I managed to get it all together. I've got everything to them and they're going to try and get it on one of the platforms. People will see it because no one really saw it till.
Well, it's a good time now as well with the strikes and everything.
Exactly, yeah.
But when you was talking about the rehab and the recovery, obviously people that are listening or watching to this will definitely have had some connection with drugs. Maybe they've been through the same experiences. Maybe they haven't. But I mean, when did you decide to actually make that, you know, step into rehab?
So things got really bad. I never went rehab. I went to some groups that really helped me. And if anyone wants to, you know, get in touch with me after. I'll put an email, one of the emails that you can contact me on. And if you, anyone needs any help in recovery, I can point them in the right direction. Amazing. Because I went to some people that had a problem, and they dealt with their problem, and then they then in turn help other people, and they helped me, you know, with my recovery, and helped me to get, and I couldn't do it myself. I needed these people to help me.
What was some of the things they did? Were they just?
Well, they had a program outlined, and then we went through the program bit by bit, and it's a tried and true method that loads of people have been through, and yeah, like I said, if anyone, you know, wants to get in touch with me after, I'd be more than, and that's what I do now. I still help people. Nice. Like in recovery, and help them to get clean, and that's just one of the things that we do. We get clean, and then we help others get clean, and we pass it on.
But when you said at the beginning, 15 years, I mean, 15 that is years. A long time.
Yeah, and I'd like to take credit for it, but I can't. I honestly can't. I couldn't do it myself. You know, my life got so bad.
But you must have learned some discipline to be able to keep it going. This
well,
long,
all I did was I took the instruction from these people that had gone before me, and I just put one foot in front of the other and done what they said, and as a result, I've managed to be free. By the grace of whatever it is.
You've been let go by the cocaine gods.
Yeah, I've been let go by the cocaine. And you know what? I'm not anti-cocaine.
Right.
Cocaine is just a drug.
Right.
It's not a problem. It just is what it is.
Right, okay.
You know, it's us that the problem. Like what you said, religion is not a problem. It's the fucking people in the religion that are the problem. It's man. It's always man and his ego and his fear and his selfishness and dishonesty that causes all the trouble, you know? Like you say, God is just, if there is a God, it's just love and connection. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So you, after turnaround.
Turnout, yeah.
Sorry, what?
Everyone gets the title, Rob. We should have called it something else.
Yeah, you should have called it turnaround.
We should have done it.
But now on turnout, I do remember it now. I can see the things. It had Fernando on the front, didn't it?
Yeah. There was a few of us on the front. But they wanted, like, Revolver, they wanted to stick guns on it, and there was not even a gun in it. No one even got...
That's what I remember. I'm sure it's him standing with a gun, right?
No.
Quite big.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't that one. No. At one point, they wanted a gun.
Maybe that's turnaround.
Maybe that's turnaround. It's a different film.
But turnout was that film. And then where did you go from there? What was your next...
So then, you know, like my drive to get that film made was just like, you know what it's like. It was like, I want to get that made, and after that, I can die like an happy man, you know. And then that comes out, and you're never happy, are you? No. Like, you're always looking at the fucking negatives.
Whatever acting work you did, whatever filmmaking work you did, whatever you end up doing, and it's a great thing for life.
Yeah.
When people say, if only I could buy that house, I'd be happy. If only I could buy that watch. If only I could buy them shoes. If only I could marry that woman. Everyone has like a list of things they want to achieve.
Yeah.
Then when they achieve them, they go, oh, my life's complete. And then it's like, actually, I want my kid.
Yeah.
And it's the same with films. You make a film tomorrow that's number one at the box office in the UK. The next film you want to make, you go, well, I want to make it number one at the box office in every country.
Of course. And I think the day that you sort of think, oh, I've done it, it's over, isn't it?
So you might as well just fucking do something else.
Yeah, exactly. So that drive, I think that the Japanese have got a word for it. They call it Kaizen. And it's a continual drive for improvement. And I think you need that as an artist, you know, like you just want to do better. You want to do better. But
I love that.
You know, and I think I might go wrong. I don't know.
No, Kaizen.
I think it is.
Kaizen.
Yeah. Kaizen.
Sounds like.
But yeah, you know, like that drive for improvement. And it's what drives you. You know, you never do the perfect job. There's always hindsight. And you always want to do better. So yeah, you know, finished turnout, got it made. And it was like, well, I want to do something else, you know. And that's what I've been doing, you know, the last sort of 11 years, just writing. You know, I've written, you know, stuff with like two of my collaborators, which are Lee Sales and Greg Hall,
who's a friend. Great.
And me and Greg, you know, we've written like probably like 6 or 7 features together.
Every time I speak to Greg, he always makes me laugh because his brother is actually my accountant.
I know.
And when I see him, they're absolute ringers of each other.
Are they really? Yeah, because I've met his brother once.
When I'm talking to his brother, his older brother, very sensible, very like, you know, refined. And when you speak to Greg, he's obviously a little bit more street.
Yeah.
And every time I look at him, I always think, am I talking to my accountant? Am I talking to the writer, director?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Greg.
Yeah.
But he's a good guy, Greg.
Yeah, so me and Greg, obviously, we met on Bonded by Blood 2, you know, which was your vehicle, right?
And we met, I'll tell you what it was. The Bonded by Blood 1, but I think that's the first time we met. I'm pretty sure it was on that film because you played the lead in that.
Yeah. Bonded by Blood 2, we met on that.
Because I just had a little bit in that.
Yeah, that's it.
I think they just wanted to, I don't know why, but it was more like...
But I think you own the rights to it.
No, what happened was Bernard O'Mahony.
Right.
I think he had some sort... We on the first one, we had the rights to make the film, and I think he wanted to... Jonathan Southcott wanted to do Bonnie Blood 2.
Yeah.
And I think he spoke to Bernard. And for us, it was like, we didn't really want to make Bonnie Blood 2. So yeah. For us, it was like, well, if there's another film that comes out, hopefully it generates some interest. You watch that one, go and watch the first one. So for us, it was more of a...
I mean, that story was an incredible story. Like, that story's got so much legs. I don't think we executed it at the best. It was really low budget, wasn't it? You know, and
I think the problem... I think that's one of the big problems in the UK is not a funding mechanism, right, where you can actually draw down proper money to make good quality films. And obviously there is, you know, you do get Netflix and Amazon and the studios funded stuff.
Mm.
But they tend to fund stuff that, you know, is star-driven, director-driven, the writer-driven. And obviously when you do that, all of a sudden the budget's not going to be half a million or a million. It's going to be like 10 or 15 or 20 million.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's always very difficult to get those films put together. Because, you know, if you went to Guy Ritchie and said, oh, Guy, you know, I want to attach you to this project, he's probably going to go, well, mate, I can write my own stuff and I can pick up the phone to Henry Cavill, Jason Statham, and I can just do it myself.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you're in that position of power, I don't blame any of these people for doing it, because I do it. Do you know what I mean?
Why would you outsource when you can do it all in-house?
Why would I want to help you do your stuff when I do it myself?
Help myself, But like, that story was brilliant. You know, that was a really brilliant story. And the guy that I played, Damon Alvin, there was a really mad connection that I didn't know at the time. So obviously, like, I'm big into sort of trying to do research if there is any.
Was it Ricky Purcell? He was in that as well, wasn't he?
He was in that as
Ricky Purcell, Damon Alvin.
Damon Alvin and the young kid, is it Dean Blundett?
I think so.
Dean, was it Blundell, I think it could
be. It might be,
Blundell, I think. I've got the young boy that got killed. Anyway, Damon Alvin obviously went into the witness protection program, and so I was trying to find out as much as I could, and you couldn't. It was not even a photograph of him. After the film came out, I found out that my dad's sister owned the pub, was the landlady of the pub that they used to go in, where a lot of the film was set, called The Woodcutters. Right. She was the landlady. She knew Damon. She knew all that, Mom, so I could have spoken to her, but, you know, missed a trick there.
But, you know, that's hindsight.
Another mad bit of synchronicity. Yeah. Like, what's the odds of that? That my at that time when that was all going on, my aunt was the landlady, you know, of that pub.
And then what happened after Bonded by Blood 2? What did you do after that?
So then we were just like, me and Greg met on that. So that's how me, and we were sort of in a similar position. You know, we sort of, we got the same taste in films, music, lived around the corner from each other. Right. We had daughters the same age, and we were just like, let's do something together. And we just clicked. And then ever since then, me and him have been writing. And obviously we've written a couple of shorts that I've led and he's directed that have done really well. The last one, Baby Boy, was like
I saw that.
Channel 4 for like a year. And it, you know, got into the Irish Prize, which is a massive, you know, massive festival. And then we wrote Villain, which obviously that got made by Phil Barantini.
Number one on Netflix as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, number one on Netflix in the UK and in New Zealand and Australia, you know, New York Times Critics' Choice, you know, done really, really well. And obviously Phil Barantini, Bart Ruspoli, who produced it, and the DOP, Matthew, I forget his second name now, but he they all went on and did Boiling Point, you know, nominated for BAFTA as a shooting TV series now. You know, so they're all, you know, it was a good team, and the film, come out really well.
Well, it's good. It's good when you're, whether you're an actor, whether you're a writer, whether you're a producer, whether you're a director of any film, that does any sort of business, you know. And you know, Villain, you know, it was. I mean, I watched it and I thought it was a well put together film.
Yeah,
and I thought it was a good vehicle for you. Obviously, Craig done a great job in it. Mm. You know, I'm sure. Villain 2 will happen at some point.
Well, you know, some we're working on something. I don't know about a 2, but something set in the Villain universe. You know, like something of that thing. And you know, and it was just an example of like, it was obviously really low budget.
Yeah.
We needed more money really to do all that we wanted to do. So we had to sort of change the script quite a lot because the script was a little bit more art house. Right. But you know, we made a great film, and it's just an example of like, you know, you can write good stuff, good genre stuff. I mean, I felt one of the films I loved recently was a few years ago now, but The Drop. Did you see that movie, The Drop?
Who
James Gandolfini and Tom Hardy.
Yeah, of course.
It's a simple story, amazing film. You know, and I like that was a big inspiration for like Villain, because like you can write these really good, you know, crime movies. And they don't need to be schlocky, and they don't need to fall onto cliche or you know, exposition. You can write really intelligent crime pieces. If one, you know how to write. Two, you've got good points of reference, so you've got good taste. And three, you know that world. Right, you right, see, right. You come from that world. I come from that world. I'm not a gangster, not nobody, but I know that world. I know right. when I'm being lied to and when I'm being told the truth. Right. It's like Succession as well, though. I think we all know. Yeah. Succession, the series, right? Do you see it?
Yeah, of course.
So I'm not a billionaire. I don't knock about with billionaires, but when I'm watching it, I feel like I'm being told the truth.
Right.
Because there's truth in it. Because there's an authenticity, you know.
I love Brian Cox's character.
Oh mate, he's right. brilliant. He's exactly. brilliant. And what's the other? Is it Tom McFadden? Is that his name? The guy that,
yeah.
Dan. I think it's Dan McFadden, the guy that plays Tom. Anyway, that fucking guy, you know, I'm real. They're all great, but he's...
No, is it Matthew McFadden?
Matthew McFadden, yeah. That's it. He's out of this world, that guy.
But he plays Tom in the show, yeah.
I mean, unbelievable.
I thought, when I first watched it, someone said, have you seen this Succession show? And I watched it and I just loved it. Because there's a few friends of mine who are unfortunately no longer with us that were in New York. And one of them was a billionaire-esque, like, similar to him. And exactly the same. Like, right. just fucking fuck off. And she'd be like, and yeah. she was like in her 80s. And she
so
was,
you've knocked around those people. Yeah, you've been around them.
But literally, you know, it's just mad. When you watch something like that, there were so many memories that come back to me.
Right.
And whoever wrote that must have been around these people to get the...
This is what I'm saying, exactly. You know, or they researched, you know, like... And I've never been around them. You have, and you're saying it's real. For me, it rang true. It's like I've never been in the mafia, but when I watch Goodfellas, it rings true because there's, you know, that authenticity. You can't make it up. You have to either research the fuck out of it or you have to know it.
Well, Scorsese grew up around the mob.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And it's you know, I think...
It's in his blood. Yeah.
I think if you're in the environment... And when I was doing the clubs, I was in an environment which, you know, there was criminals, there was people that were gangs and there was people up to no good.
Sure.
And... Again, like you, I was never been interested in getting involved in that stuff, but I see it going on and I met the people and I was always respectful to them. Those were respectful.
But you watch and you find them fascinating. See, I find those people fascinating. So I'm a watcher and I'm an observer and I'm a raconteur. So I listen to the stories and I'm watching and I'm taking it all in. And then, so that's why I write, you know.
The one thing that I always find mad, like when you talk to these people, like when they're in it and they're doing it, it's all great and it's all funny and it's all this, it's all that. But then when they actually end up either getting maimed or killed or put in jail for a long time, when they come out the other side, if they're still alive, they all regret doing it. They all say, what a fucking waste of my life. Why the fuck did I do that? There's nothing cool, clever, funny about it. And you know, it's the same with these kids. You know, there's a lot of kids now that are in their 16, 17, 18-year-olds running around, stabbing people, macheting people, shooting people, thinking that, you know, if they get caught, that their street cred's going to go up. And when they come out of jail, everyone's going to be like, oh, that's the guy who did that. But then when they come out, everyone's forgotten about them.
Yeah, but and it always ends in tears.
It's crazy.
It always ends in tears, you know. And like, and if you do believe in a balance in life, you know, there's karmic energy, you know. What you put out, you get back. You put out negative energy comes back.
And that's what I've never understood, right? You know, when you see people and they're being negative, and it can be in life where you've got people that are toxic that come up to you going, oh, have you seen this? Have you seen that? Have you seen that? Have you heard this? Have you heard that? And they just spread shit all day long. And you just think, what is wrong with this person, right?
Yeah.
They've got nothing good to say. And they're always complaining. And then you've got people on the internet doing similar things. And you just sort of think, well, by you just putting out all that negativity, just going to come back on you.
It does.
There's nothing, you know, all the stuff that I've always done, I've done positively and I've pushed it out there and I've always wanted to do things well and do the best I can. And sometimes, like you found, you put your art in someone to a project and it don't work, or you put your art in someone to a project and, yeah, the critics don't like it, or it doesn't get the release you wanted or that you think the film deserved.
Yeah.
But you can't sit there crying about it. You have to just pick yourself up and go, you know what? I've learned from that. Next, right?
The difference is you're a doer.
Yeah,
you get out there and you do it, and you put yourself out there, and that's what we do. And we are like, you know, it's horrible when you get people saying bad things about you, you know, because I think it's a weird contradiction, because as artists, we're normally quite sensitive people.
But Pete, do you know what I find crazy, right? Like, and I'm sure you've had this, George. Maybe you haven't, but people will just send you a message on social media, or they're commenting on your post and just go, you're a cunt, or that film's a load of shit. And you're like, who the fuck is this person?
Exactly.
You know what I mean? It's like,
but it's always the bad ones we remember, innit? Yeah. They could say a million good fucking things, but it's always negative shit that we hang on to. You know?
I don't. I always laugh because I always just think, you know, I feel sorry for them because I actually think, you know, you're actually wasting your life sending this shit to me that I'm not interested in, I don't pay any attention to.
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes I want to go back to them and say, if you spent more time being positive and creative, maybe something good will happen in your life.
Yeah.
But I think I don't want to do that because I don't want them to think that I've actually read their message.
Yeah.
Because
they
want you to read their
message. Exactly, yeah.
They want a reaction. Yeah. So if you don't give them a reaction, someone said to me, I can't remember who it was, but it always made me laugh because I used to have fucking rounds with people. People would like send me messages and just say stupid things like you're a cunt or something like that.
Yeah.
And I'd just be like, fuck, do you think you're talking to?
You buy into it.
You're saying something to me. Come say it in my fucking face.
Yeah.
Don't keyboard warrior me. Right?
Yeah. But they've got you then. Right? Once you've done that,
then. But then I was moaning to someone. I was going, can you believe these people? They just think they can fucking send you any old shit you want and there's no repercussions.
Yeah.
And my mate said to me, he said, Terry, he said, do not feed the trolls.
Yeah.
Because he said, as soon as you feed them,
of course, that's what they want. It's like,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the funniest trolling story I heard was, and it was, I don't know if it was a UFC fight or a boxer, but someone kept going on about going, oh, your wife's ugly, you know, you're a shit boxer, your kid's like fucking got autism, like really bad stuff, right, online, just fucking tormenting this bloke. So don't ask me how he did it, but he found out where this fucking bloke lived. And knocked on his door. And the guy's opened the door and he goes, right, me and you now outside. And the guy's going, no. He goes, I was just fucking about, I didn't mean it. But he actually put it fucking on him.
Yeah,
and he filmed it and said, I'm going to put this on the internet. Fucking say you're sorry and you're going to stop being a cunt.
Yeah.
And it just made me laugh because I just thought, this guy has actually trolled the troll.
He's got him. And he's got him. That's their worst nightmare, isn't it? Like them turning up.
But genuinely, if people, because you can, anyone can set up any profile anywhere they want.
Mm.
And I genuinely think that with social media, there's kids at school that are getting trolled. There's kids committing suicide.
Sure.
There's a lot. And because in the old days, people come up to you and go, you're fat, you're ugly to your face. But they don't do it anonymously.
Of course.
And think they're getting away with it.
Yeah.
But I genuinely think the way to police social media, right? And I don't know why they don't do this, but if you want to go onto one of these platforms, you should have a passport so they know how old you are.
Right.
And you should register it and it has to be in your name.
Yeah.
And that way, if you go around trolling people or you go around saying stuff, you know, you're identifiable.
Mm.
And you know, you can be dealt with by law enforcement. But now, if you like, I could have five people setting up 10 accounts, just trolling you all day long.
Mm.
And the only way you're ever going to find out who's behind it is if you can get a court order to actually find out. So you can't actually, if you ever have a problem on any of these platforms, you can never speak to anyone.
No.
Always have to send a message and it's been reviewed.
Yeah.
You know?
No, it's true.
So it is a mad
world. I mean, it's hard when you're a kid, I guess, you know, that's the valid point because it's the kids, you know, when they're getting trolled and bullied online. I mean, that's terrible because it's such a prominent thing in society, isn't it? Like, and nowadays, like social media is something that we didn't have growing up. But I mean, being...
We got terrorised in person.
Yeah, we just... Exactly. You know, but like, I guess the thing is now, like, I just try not to, you know, take it all with a pinch of salt, the good and the bad. I mean, someone once said to me, you know, if you're going to believe the good reviews, you've got to believe the bad ones. You know, just don't believe it. Just, they're all just opinions. And they're often written by people that haven't got a fucking creative bone in their body.
That's true.
They're not even talented, you know, and we're putting ourselves out there. Like as artists, when we go out there, when you act and we do a scene, we're just exposing ourselves, you know, we're so vulnerable.
Exposing ourselves to abuse.
Yeah, exactly. We are though. We're just like, we're putting ourselves up there to be judged and,
you know. All we want to do is be loved.
We just want to be fucking loved. That's all we want is love and admiration, you know, like, villain, but we're out there doing it.
Villain for you, would you say that was a turning point in your career when you felt, wow, we're number one on Netflix in a couple of countries. And then, you know, the phone started ringing, you started getting other opportunities.
Yeah, definitely. Like, you know, it got me noticed, I think, amongst my peers, you know, and people realised that I existed. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's done really well. And just to, you know, it's something so... I spent years writing that film, me and Greg, you know, and just to see it made and realised and do well, it's a great feeling.
This is the other thing, which a lot of people watching or listening to this won't appreciate or understand how long these things take. Right. You know, like you said, years of writing, years of banging on the doors, years of trying to get it off.
I'm telling you.
And then, you know, you get it off and it could have gone the other way.
Yeah.
Could have gone nowhere.
So when first draft of Turnout, with like he's watching something on the TV, daytime TV, and it was Kilroy. Right. Remember Kilroy? Well, you have to be old to remember. And then it was Trisha.
I'm not that old.
Exactly, yeah. You know, Kilroy, then Trisha, and then Jeremy Carl. Do you know what I mean? It was like, it took 6 or 7 years to get that film off the ground, you know, to the point where you think, if we don't get it made now, I'm going to be too old to play
right.
it, you know?
Do you know what I've always thought, though, George, right, is the one thing that the film business and acting, whether you're producing, writing, acting, directing, whatever it is, the one thing that the film business and the television business teaches you is patience.
Yeah, for sure.
Because you have to be patient.
Yeah, and, 100%. Nothing moves quick, does it?
And I remember speaking to Bill Murray, right? And I actually said to him, you know, fucking hell, I've got this film, it's down the hour, blah, blah, blah. And he looked at me and he went, Terence, he said, it happens when it happens. Mm. And if it doesn't happen, it wasn't meant to happen. Mm. I was sat there and I was thinking, fucking right.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was just funny that,
yeah,
you know, it was just very just like, well, you know, don't drive yourself fucking mad.
Mm-mm.
But the beautiful thing about, I think, creating content is once you've created it, it's there.
Exactly.
So even if it doesn't happen today, tomorrow,
it's
next
there.
Year.
It's never going to get made if you don't write it. You know what I mean?
You own the IP.
You've got it here, and then when the opportunity presents itself, you can slip it in. And that's how both Villain and Turnout got made. Just like a little window opened up. I went, oh, I've got something. Bang. And they happened, you know.
And then obviously, fast forward from Villain, and then we're in lockdown, aren't we?
Yeah.
And then we get the phone call about Origins.
Origins, exactly,
which
yeah.
was mad. And that must have been exciting for you, because obviously to come into a franchise.
Such a massive franchise.
It's a new character as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was a good one because Andy said it was a mishmash of two characters, so there wasn't one character to base it on. So I had a bit of free reign to play with it. And I wanted to do something different. And like, bless them, like Nick and Andy both gave me the room and the platform to really play about with that character and create something that was a little bit different, you know, and I nicked little bits and pieces from everywhere. Like even the Basil and Joe thing, that come from Kalito's Way, actually, where Benny Blanco references himself in the third person. You know, I'm Benny Blanco. So, you know, I am, I'm Basil and Joe. So all that come from, you know, just nicking little bits and pieces from little things of building this character from scratch. It was great fun, the peroxide air. And they were just going, yeah, go on, go for it. Try it. They really got behind me rather than going, oh, hold on a minute.
I had so many people when that film came out messaging me going, I know a guy called Joe Basil. Is it him? I was like,
yeah.
I have no clue.
Yeah.
It was just, but I don't know about you, George, but when that lockdown happened and we found ourselves in Southend for 4 or 5 weeks, however long it was, in October, November 2020.
Yeah.
It was fucking great.
It bunkered up in that hotel, wasn't it? It was brilliant, wasn't it? It was great.
Like the world's ending and we're all just
making
a laugh on
And good, you know, at you and Andy, you know, you was fearless, man. You just went out there and got it done, you know?
People said to me, like at the time, you know, how are you going to fucking raise the money for this? Because you can't actually go and meet anybody. You can't really see anybody. And I went, do you know what? I said, I'm just going to phone up people that I know who've invested previously and just see, you know, if anyone fancies
the feelers out.
And people said to me, yeah, you fucking mad. You're making a film that you don't know when the pandemic's going to be over. So how are people going to watch film? I said, well, everyone's watching fucking Netflix and Amazon.
Yeah.
So worst case scenario, it comes out on Netflix and Amazon. Right. But I said, hopefully cinemas will open up and this thing will go away at some point.
Mm.
Right. But in a weird sort of way, when we did it, obviously it went out.
And the timing was perfect because the cinema sort of opened up as it came out.
Well, what happened was it was a little bit potty because normally what's happened historically, when Foot Soldier Marbella come out, it always come out like November time and then Boxing Day it'd go out on DVD.
Yeah.
So it never got a big cinema release. It just went out on like 20, 30 cinemas.
Right.
Then it went on a premium pay-per-view, then it went out DVD, Blu-ray and rental Boxing Day. And then we used to do Marbella Film Festival first week in October.
Mm-hmm.
Then a month later, we'd be doing, obviously, the premiere, and then it'd be out. And that was the sort of model, the Foot Soldier 3, Pate Story, they did it on that. Marbella did it on that. And then, obviously, when we were doing origins, we were like, great, pandemic's over now, all back to normal. And then all of a sudden, everything starts shutting down again. And it was like, for fuck's sake. And I remember, like, the Marbella Film Festival moved the Marbella Film Festival early.
Yeah.
Because they were worried that there was going to be another pandemic and it was going to shut down again.
Right.
The cinema, the distributor said, let's get it out early September, because if we don't, the cinemas might all be shut again.
Right.
So everyone was panicking.
Yeah.
I mean, if they had just done it as it was, it would have been okay, but nobody wanted to take that risk. But then it went out and it was number 10 at the box office.
That's right.
Which what a lot of people don't realise about cinema is the only films that really get into the top 10 are normally, you know, superhero movies and big budget, 50, 100.
American films.
Big budget films.
Yeah.
Because you know, I get it, because people say, why would I pay £15 to go and watch a low budget British film here?
Yeah.
We're not going to go and watch a £300 million film in Hollywood on the same screen.
Exactly.
On the same day. So I think as independent filmmakers, we're never ever going to, I mean, look, I've had a couple of films that have broken out of the box office, but you know, it's, you never ever, you're always fighting against the big guys.
Yeah, I always ask people, when was the last time you went to watch a British film in the cinema? Not a screening or a premiere or something like that. When was the last time you paid money out of your pocket to go and watch a British film? A lot of people can't even remember.
Well, the worst thing for me, and this is one of my sort of pet gripes, is you talk to people now, and I talk to all sorts of people, rich, middle, poor, right? And they all say the same thing now. Oh, when's it coming on Netflix?
Yeah.
Is it coming on Amazon?
Exactly.
And you go, well, we haven't sold it to them yet.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll wait till it comes on there. And you're like, when I was growing up, when that film's coming out, I had to see it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Now it's sort of like, oh, I'll wait till it comes to Netflix.
Yeah, yeah.
Why are you doing that? Well, I'm paying $9.99 a month. I'll have it when it comes out. So the urgency of, and I think the only thing that can help is if there's some hype behind the film, and if people have to see it for whatever reason, or have you seen this film? And you know, I think obviously with Rise of the Foot Soldier Origins, that was the first time I ever played a lead in a movie, which was amazing. Obviously, Vinny, first time he'd been in the thing. First time you've been in the film, obviously you're bouncing on villains.
That's why they come out to watch it, obviously, because I'll...
Right, you'd be the lucky charm. Basil Joe's in the house, right? And to have it, have that big premiere in Leicester Square.
It's amazing.
And then to see the love and the people. And you know, it was an odd conversation, though, because obviously, if you'd have had the phone call saying, oh, we're doing a prequel to the first one.
Yeah.
15, so we're going to go back 15 years. You sort of think, well, how's that going to work? So I'm obviously a little bit older now.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think the fans, they just,
I think you've got to have a bit of creative freedom and license, haven't
you? Doesn't matter.
And, you know, and they're fun movies. They're not made to win Academy Awards. They're fun movies and they deliver, you know, on every level.
I mean, if you look at the new one that's just come out, Rise of Foot Soldier Vengeance, we had a great premiere in September.
Amazing.
That was the first premiere has ever sold out 2 weeks before.
Wow.
I had people ringing me up and messaging me saying, I want to come at premiere, I want to buy a table, I want to buy tickets. I'm like, there's none. We actually had 200 people too many wanted to come. And that was at the end of August.
Yeah.
So we had to start saying, sorry, guys.
Yeah. I mean, the magnitude of the event like that, it's just massive, isn't it? It's just massive. Everything's done as big as you can do it. Really,
well, that's, you can't do a bigger, you could do numbers wise, but I think the reason why we picked the Odeon in Leicester Square was because you're all in one room, and that is a room in it. I mean, you're sitting in these massive chairs,
some room.
And then we had that great after party at Proud, the film was 11 in the box office,
I know, it's just done
so, brilliant. So it didn't get to number 10 like Origins, but. I genuinely think, again, when you look at what's on, I know it's not the same thing, but Barbie movie, you've got all these massive, huge
$200 million movies.
Yeah.
You know
and you think you've got your little independent, but it's still punching well above its weight.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think everybody that saw the movie said it didn't feel like a foot soldier film. But the idea behind it was obviously, it was more like a kind of Get Carter, a revenge movie. And I think, in essence, it's good because the next step will be Rise of the Foot Soldier Ibiza. And that's obviously going to be going back to the foot soldier, you know, the guys being silly, the drugs, the girls, the whatever. But again, you know, I think it's nice to switch it up.
Mm.
And it's also nice to bring in some new people. Like Anthony Scordi was amazing in it.
Brilliant.
Jeff Bell.
Everyone was great in it.
You know,
Little Ben Wilson.
Yeah, you had people.
Fantastic young actor.
You had people that hadn't appeared in any Rise of Foot Soldier movies.
Yeah,
and,
and
obviously we can talk about this now because obviously this will be probably out.
All right.
Mid to late December.
What spoilers you mean?
But lots of people die in this one.
Yeah, they do. They do.
But that doesn't mean that they're not going to come back.
Exactly. Or in the foot soldier world, you know, anything can happen.
Anything's possible. People get regenerated. People come back to life. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
But what was your favourite moments on Origins?
Well, I just think that last set piece, the finale, is up there with any film, you know, big budget, low budget, British crime movie. I mean, it's just a fantastic set piece finale. When he walks into that club and there's the shot behind him, Craig. And Craig, what's he like? Like, he just, like, he's got that same, that's why he would have been great to play Lenny. He's got that same presence. Yeah, I wish I had that fucking presence, you know. Like, you just put the camera on Craig and it loves him. He's a fantastic actor as well. But just when he walks in that club from behind with that shotgun and no one notices, they're all going about their business. And just from then on, it just the film just fucking just skyrockets and beautifully shot. Soho at night in the rain. It's just epic, mate, you know, and I loved it. I was really, really impressed with the whole film. It's just a slick movie, you know, they put the money, you know, it's low budget comparatively, you know, compared to them other films we were talking about. It's nothing. It's a drop in the ocean. And yet they put all that money up there on the screen and make it look great. And it's a triumph. You know, everyone should be just chuffed with themselves. They've done a really good job. Pleasure to be a part of it.
So what's your plans for the future now, George?
So I'm just writing, you know. So I've got a film at the moment. This just been optioned. I've written with Greg. We're just sorting out the contracts with that now. Me and Greg have just finished writing a feature film that we've already got a producer attached who's done like 30 films before, and she reckons she's almost got the money. We've almost written that on spec, and that's the best thing me and Greg have ever written. And we're working on a couple of TV things. We've got another TV thing with a production company at the moment. And I really like TV. I've never written TV before. And I think that's where like films always celebrate the director. It's always like, you know, who directed it. Not so much about the writers.
TV's
the writers that are the new auteurs. They're celebrated, you know. So I really like the idea of that.
I think it's funny about TV. I mean, I remember back in the day, when I first got involved in the business, like all the TV people were looking at film people going, oh, I really want to be there.
Yeah.
And then the TV people go, why don't you come down here? And the film people were like, no, we're not doing that.
Yeah.
And now it's got flipped around. But you know. I think, you know, when they started making like movies as episodes of TV, that's when it changed. And when you started seeing people spending millions on each episode.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
And you know, I think, obviously, Netflix was one of the pioneers of that.
HBO,
but they all started deciding, right, we got to really get people switched into TVs or subscribing, we've got to give them really good quality.
Mm.
And I think, you know, again, these things have all created issues, right? And the biggest issue in film is obviously now people want, you know, the big budget, the director, the writer, the A-star actors. For it to really have a chance of succeeding.
Mm.
Otherwise, it's sort of like, well, you know, you haven't really got anybody in it. So it's made the independent sector, especially, I'd say, in 2022, 2023, massively hard. Obviously, coming out of COVID, and obviously the studios have had to ramp stuff up because people aren't going to the cinema, so they've decided, well, actually, we spend more and we get, you know, make it bigger, people will come. And I don't think that's happened.
No.
Right.
I think the arsehole's got to fall out of it at some point because they're throwing all this money behind these big franchises. And I think sooner or later it will, I have to have faith.
Well, it is. Well, it is.
It will come back round just to filmmaking.
But it is.
Quality
but
format.
That's I believe that's what's happening. So. I believe that's what's happening now.
Yeah.
And I think the difficult thing about TV is, again, it's like you've got to have the writer from this, the showrunner from that, the director from this. And obviously if you're Steven Spielberg or Tom Hanks, then great, you know.
Yeah.
But for the rest of us, you know, we're all trying to obviously get up there. But I think they've all got themselves into this kind of slightly bad predicament. I mean, Cineworld went out of business. They $7 billion, right? And
what, in debt?
They went out of business, right? Yeah. So what they did was they wiped out all of that debt.
Right.
And then they went, we're going to raise some more money now because, you know, we've got XYZ happening. But obviously, if you've had a business that's lost that much money,
yeah,
there must be someone somewhere that goes, this obviously isn't working.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah.
And you know, so I don't know what the future of cinema is.
Yeah.
But I think things like the electric, the everyman will work because people like the luxury, the bottle of wine, the food.
Sure.
It's a different experience. But I think the days of the multiplexes are definitely numbered.
Yeah, and it's expensive to go to the cinema now, you know.
100 quid.
Like, yeah, it used to be a thing you could take your kids and it would be a cheap sort of like night out. But now it's just, yeah, like you say, it's 100 quid a pop.
I used to go 3 times a week.
Mm.
Right? That's how mad I was in the cinema.
Mm.
And it'd be like 7 quid.
You'd
have hot dog, popcorn, Fiora. Yeah.
We're for that 7 quid. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now it's sort of like, we won't have the cure, we won't have the hot dog, we'll have the popcorn. Exactly. We'll bring our own water, you know.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But also I think what's happened with a lot of the streaming platforms, and it's the same with the music, right? You pay a certain amount a month and you get everything.
Yeah.
And the problem is, it's great for consumers, but it's bad for the creators. And if you think, you know, if you create content, whether you're an investor in content, whether you're creating content, whether you're a producer, writer, doesn't matter who you are, if you are relying on getting paid for your content and then people are going, well, we're going to give you this for it, I'm going to give it away to all these people for free. You know, nobody ever tells you, you know, oh, 200 million people have watched your film.
Yeah,
right,
they don't Netflix want to give you the figures.
And that's why, you know, the writers and the actors are on strike right now.
Mm.
And people are saying, well, you know, about AI, I think AI is part of it, but the real reason is they're not getting the residuals.
Not getting the residuals.
And obviously, if you're a union, and your money is paid through residuals, and you're not getting any money.
Exactly.
And then you go, well, hang on a minute, that film you starred in, or that film you produced, or that film you wrote, is going out to 238 million people worldwide.
Yeah.
And you're getting paid that money. And
someone's
else.
Getting some money somewhere, aren't they? You know what I mean?
But the model is great for the consumer.
Yeah.
But it's bad for the creators.
Right, yeah.
So what will happen if they solve the strike, which I don't see how they will, but they're going to have to, the only way it's going to get solved is if I think the streaming platforms say, well, we will give people residuals. But then if they do that,
they're going to
put the prices up.
Yeah, all right, got you.
And if you put the prices up, you know, it's not going to go up £1 a month.
Yeah,
it's going to go up 10, 20, 30.
And not only that, there's only so many that you can subscribe to a month if you're a normal person. Do you know what I mean? So then you have to start cancelling subscriptions, right, I guess.
Yeah, but that's the things in our business right now that you look at and are worrying are what's going to happen with the cinemas, right?
Mm.
And obviously, if the cinemas do shrink or go out of business and there's only a handful of IMAXs and Everymans, then obviously that means that the box office takings aren't going to be very big for these movies. And obviously all the box office takings are linked to the deals they get with the streaming platforms and broadcasters. So if there's no box office, there's no deal. So then they have to renegotiate the deals. And if I was one of those platforms and some company said, well, cinemas aren't delivering anymore, we're going to stop putting stuff out of cinemas, but do you want to buy a £200 million movie? I'd say, well, yeah, I'll give you £1 million for it.
Yeah,
and if they say, well, we're not going to take that, so we don't fucking put it out then.
Mm.
And then they're sitting there with this film, so then all the studios are going to have to try and set up a streaming service, and Paramount have already done it.
Right.
And I think Universal have already done it, but they're not obviously as far down the road as Netflix, Amazon, Apple, Disney. So there is going to be a bit of a war.
Yeah.
And I think there is going to be some casualties next year.
Yeah,
so, but for airspace, the independents, you know,
it's a window, isn't it?
I think you know, I've created a lot of content, and there is a waiver you can get now, where if you can get things privately financed, you can actually still make stuff,
right?
And they allow the actors to work on it,
okay? Right,
but only if it's privately financed. If you say, well, Netflix or Amazon or Universal are on it, then they can't work,
right?
So we're putting some things together now where we're working around that. But again.
Good stuff.
You know, but it's, again, challenging and it's hard. There's no easy route, you know.
See, I have to just hope that all this stuff will write itself, you know. I mean, I'm not a producer, really, you know. I'm just, I write and...
You're a creator.
Exactly, you know, and I'm a creative. And, like what you say, you know, you create the content and you hope that the opportunity presents itself where you can... Because it's like I was speaking to someone the other day. It's Craig, actually, and he said it's all about timing.
I think what you've got to do as well is if you're creative, right, whatever they say about artificial intelligence, artificial intelligence that isn't creative. Mm. You can tell it what you want them to do, write a story about this and about that, mm-hmm. and it'll do whatever it thinks is right.
Yeah.
And in a way, it can manipulate, oh, people like this, so put this in, and people like that, put that in.
Yeah.
And it can be everything to everyone.
Mm.
But the problem with that is it becomes like a fucking politician.
Yeah.
Or it becomes like one of these people that, you know, you ask them a question and they don't answer it, and they just go, oh, you know, whatever, whatever, and they just go around the houses. Whereas with being a creative, you know, I think the reason why the Rise of the Foot Soldier films have been successful and people have watched them and people are drawn to the franchise, it's not because, like you said, they're not going to win any Academy Awards, but there's something... Not yet. But there's something in the DNA of that which is controversial and makes people want to watch it.
Yeah.
And it's because it's being written and created by real people. And exactly. I think you can't replace creatives, in my opinion. And, you know, I'm not a geek, so I might be wrong.
But I
don't think you can create creatives. I think you've either got it or you haven't.
Yeah, and
I think we always have a job. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think so as well. You know, and I've messed about a little bit with AI when writing and stuff. And I'm very like, you know, it's new to me. And I'm like you say, I'm not really like a technical geek or anything like that. I'm probably a bit late to the party, but like I just don't think it can sort of supplement like real people, you know what I mean? Not yet anyway. I'm sure it might get to that
in
point,
5 years,
mate. Maybe, but you know, you still there'll always be people that want to go back to something written by people, just like people want to collect vinyl now, you know. We're always drawn back to, like, there'll always be Renaissance people that want the real deal, you know.
But that's going back to what you were saying earlier, I think all of this stuff that's happening now, like you said, it's got to come to a conclusion. There's got to be some
kickback almost.
It feels like a perfect storm, right? It feels like, you know, what with cost of living, interest rates, businesses failing, this, that, and the other. It does feel like the world's fucking in a crazy place.
It does at times.
But in a way, right, out of chaos comes opportunity. Mm. And I do think that, you know, if you've got the right stuff and you're in the right place,
yeah,
when all the chaos happens, you know, if all of a sudden the studios can't go, well, there's 250 billion, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, they're going to go, we need somebody that can make this cheaper. Now,
yeah,
if all you do is make films for 200 million and someone says make it for a million, you're not going to go, leave it to me. You're going to go, it's not possible.
Yeah.
Right? So the people that can actually do stuff
that, yeah,
on that level,
mm,
could be 500,000, it could be 3 million, but
yeah,
it's a lot cheaper than 200 million. Mm. And I think people will have to adjust what they get paid, you know? Yeah. So in the old days, you know, you had movie stars basically commanding whatever they wanted.
Mm.
And now you've got, you know, Netflix doing a TV show with a couple of unknown actors in it that are good,
yeah,
right? Or that have established, but they're not movie stars.
Mm.
And now, all of a sudden, because that show's gone out to 230 million, they're now hottest thing since sliced bread.
Yeah.
But they're probably under contract for the next 5 years or 10 years or whatever with Netflix.
With that,
so it's like going back to the old studio model, you know. Mm. So I think whatever happens in the world, something good will come out of it, but you just got to make sure you're in the right place at the right time.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
But George, I've really enjoyed having you on the show.
Yeah,
mate.
Thanks for having me, mate. It's been wonderful.
And it's good talking about your career, about your life, about your experiences. And I look forward to working with you in the future,
wicked
either
tell.
As an actual, as a producer.
Wicked time. Sure we will, mate.
Or as a fanboy.
Nice one, tell. Nice thanks one, for mate. Having me, mate.
Thanks for watching the Criminal Connection podcast. And what a guest George Russo was. I hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you tune in next week, Friday, 5 p.m. for another exciting guest. Criminal Connection podcast with the Podfather, Terry Stone.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.